This is Jim Fetzer on Light on Conspiracies with Ole Dimegaard.
I'm convinced that it is one of the most unjust wars that has ever been fought in the history of the world.
Welcome back to Light on Conspiracies, the second part for subscribers only.
I'm here with my friend and excellent researcher, UK critical thinker, and today we're going through the alleged attack in Manchester, where he has made an excellent documentary about the whole thing, taking it down in great details, taking it apart and showing us step by step what might have happened this evening. One of the things that I think is excellent with this documentary is where you pinpoint the different locations of where different videos have been filmed from, because that gives you a much better overview of what actually happened inside the arena. So could you tell us a little bit about that, how you did it, and or are you so familiar with this arena that you could just see it right away?
No, it was so painstaking. I mean, first thing to do was that when these videos were being released, they were being released in no order whatsoever. You know, they were making absolutely sure that they showed you the most impacting videos. So the girl who hears the bomb, or the girl who's running towards an exit and people are falling over the sides. You know, they were making sure that they showed you that over and over. But then there was lots of other videos that didn't get just as much news coverage. So first thing was to just gather them as quickly as possible, because one of the tactics when it comes to these attacks is that either you find a piece of evidence and then you don't know where it's gone, it suddenly just disappears off the face of the earth. Anything that is put on Twitter, as soon as the account is deleted, which is something I encountered with Manchester, was that I could swear blindly that I saw something, I saw a video of some kind that showed this, that and the other. You go find it, it's gone. You know, the account was just put up only for the purpose of showing the video. So, as I say, it was a case of gathering all these videos, sticking them all on this server, as I say, in a folder that was just called Twitter videos. And then I sat on that for a while, and then I thought, right, I need to do this documentary. I need to do it right as well. So it was just the logical way of looking at it was, the arena itself, you can get a map of it and you know where the seating arrangements are. The way to put it into a timeline that I felt was most sensible was the density, the amount of people that were actually still in the room at the time. So of course, first thing to do was to get a clip of a girl who was filming right up until the very end, because not only did that prove that the bomb happened after the blast, it also disproved anybody who said otherwise, which was quite a lot of people. Then it was a case of just, as I say, pinpointing people in certain places and just marrying it up to try and almost make it simple for everybody. You know, the videos themselves don't show all too much, but at least it just clarified what was everybody's state at the time. You know, were they actually really panicking? Was it absolutely carnage like the news made out? In my opinion, the people in the arena didn't really know what had happened, which is what led my conclusion that what happened in that foyer wasn't anywhere near the level of what has been described by the people in the foyer. And again, you know, the photograph sort of proves that it does, you know, it's not damaged. So it would explain why the people in the arena who were filming hadn't a clue what was going on, which seems very strange for a bomb that's supposed to have made a crater in the ground and shattered glass and busted all these doors and windows. So, it was painstaking, but it worked in good effect. And it ended up leading me on to one of the girls who filmed. As I say, she's key to all this, because her footage was used over and over and over because it showed people falling over banners. You know, look at these poor girls, they're all panicking, they're all trampling each other to get out. But when they actually listen to the girl's version, she hears two blasts. And not just bang and an echo. She says, a bomb goes off. She turns around. She looks at her friend. And then another bomb goes off and she turns around again. So why are the media happily using her footage but ignoring her story? Well, the reason is because it doesn't fit the narrative. And that's what I've tried to get across in the documentary.
I think you did an excellent job there, especially also pointing out that it seems like first there was this alleged explosion out in the foyer. But But then they amplified it. So I think to make sure that everybody heard that there was an explosion, but over the sound system. And can you tell us a bit about how you managed to point out exactly that it was from the sound system? What gives it away?
When it came to the early reports of what had happened, as I say, the footage to do with the girl who hears the blast, that was played over and over. And of course, they're going to play that because it's a hard hitting piece of footage. You know, the girl's listening to the background music of the music that's sort of just playing in the arena after the gig is finished. She then hears this noise and turns around and says, "Oh my God, and what's going on?" And, and you can hear people panicking and stuff like that. It's, for what it is, it's a powerful piece of footage. But when this got released to the likes of us, our community, the people that sort of look at these things and don't take anything on face value, and a lot of people said, "That's a speaker. That's not a bomb. That's come from a speaker." For me, I couldn't say that right from the get-go, because it could be and it might not be. But then when you were piecing everything together, and then you look back at previous events where you have Euro 2016, they had a drill, and the drill shows people running across like an entrance to a stadium, and the speaker makes the noise of a bang and all the people just fall over. Then you had one that was happening in real time when the Paris attacks were happening in 2015. There were three incidents that were happening at that time. And I don't know about everybody else or where you're from, Ollie, but here in the UK, when you say the Paris attacks in 2015, the only thing they think of is the Bataclan. They don't think of the other two that happened at the same time. And one of those being football matches going on, suicide bomber tries to get inside, gets told, "No, you're not coming in," because he didn't have a ticket or whatever. He blows himself up. He blows himself up and kills nobody. I mean, there seems to be almost nothing more sadder than a suicide bomber who can't kill somebody. And anyway, so the thing is as far as proof of that happening, there's just nothing. There really is, other than just like an initial report that that's what's supposed to have happened and that's the reason behind the noise. There really is nothing to prove that even happened, other than whilst this football match is going on the inside, a bang goes off and it sounds like a speaker. And the fans, the players, they all react to it like it's a speaker because they just carried on playing football. They didn't stop and come back on later. They just carried on. You think, this is supposed to be a bomb. And it was the same sort of thing with the arena. Even when the speaker had made this noise, people were still sort of like, "Was that a speaker? Did I hear that?" And some people say, "Was it a balloon that popped?" One guy got told by security that it was an air conditioning unit that fell off the wall. It was just so weird. And you think, if it's a bomb, it's a bomb.
I tell you, it was actually three suicide bombers in Paris that evening at the same time as the Bataclan. They claim, but there was absolutely not one single drop of blood, no footage of where the explosions were. There were 10 minutes in between them. Like first they blow them, one blows himself up, nobody reacts, and then 10 minutes later, boom, the next one. And I mean, absolute ridiculous. But what I've found with this sound system was what you pointed out in the documentary, is that the music is there and then boom, the explosion is there. But when the explosion goes off, the music stops and then it comes back. The natural thing would be music, boom, and the music continues even though there was a massive bang. But here, that explosion is on the tape, on the recording for sure, because music, bang, stop, then fade in music again. So that gives it away totally. So I thought that was really well spotted.
As I say, there's many people that were pointing it out. Don't get me wrong, it's not a eureka moment as such. But when I was putting these things together and thinking, right, I believe this is what has happened in this room. How can they do it? Right. Number one, they close the doors. Number two, they shut down the McDonald's to keep anybody who, nobody's going to go up there because there's nothing to go up there for. And then number three, you've got the car park itself. There's doors there, so you just keep them closed. And then you've got you've obviously got the arena security who can do their bit, which is just to make people go a different way. And again, that was another major part in the whole thing, and certainly letting the dust settle when it came to this as well, because you could jump to a conclusion. You could quite easily be wrong. You could just say there was no bomb, but then you could be wrong. In my opinion, there's two blasts, in the sense of there are two noises. There's one that went off in the foyer for the purpose of people near the foyer. They need to be scared away from it, and they've got to hear it just enough, but not enough to obviously actually cause any damage to anybody. And then the speaker, as you say, is to make sure that anybody else that's still sticking around, they get the noise, and they get the effect that something must have happened, and it shoos them out the back door. But what they did is, there's two people that I managed to get accounts from, one from on the night and the following day, where she says that her and her daughter, they plan to leave early, beat the rush, which is a common thing to do with concerts, especially if you're driving. You know, you don't want to get stuck in all the traffic. So what they do is they leave, daughter goes to the toilet and comes back out. Her and her daughter then walk towards the foyer, specifically say towards the foyer, which is where the car park is, and there is a line of security people. So she must mean the guys that are in yellow. Guys in yellow say to her, this isn't the best way for you to go. You should go the other way. They turn around, bang. Then the woman proceeds to talk about how she thinks that they've saved her life. And you go, no, do you not see that they must have known something was going to happen? And then it was a few months later, it was actually my girlfriend. She was watching a TV program called Educating Manchester, which is a bit of a TV series where, like a fly on the wall documentary, where they're just seeing what schools are like in Manchester. And because the Manchester bombing was hot topic at the time, they did an episode that sort of focused around it. You know, what was the reactions of the children about this bombing? You know, and one of the girls says, well, I was there and I tried to leave via the foyer and I couldn't because I was being blocked. And then the bomb went off. So I thought, brilliant, right, there's another person who said that. And it would totally make sense as to how this has happened. They've kept the room intact. You know, that is the stage almost. They can't let the normal people inside the arena go anywhere near that foyer until afterwards. And then once the bomb has gone off, and that's it, just get everybody away, and that was that. But it was a massive piece of foreknowledge to come across those two things.
So we have one critical question here. If this was not a real event, then we have 22 dead people. That is a major mystery. Have you looked into these alleged deaths?
I found that there's quite a few that have got very little profile. This is the most difficult thing about doing these sort of things. You always get asked the question, well, how did he do it? And my answer, and it's a bit of a cop-out, I know, but the way I say it is that we are always from the outside looking in. We're never going to know the intricate details as to how they do it. So, for example, the youngest girl who's supposed to have died, there's a website called Ancestry, and you can look up people's family trees and so on. You can find out, you know, are they a legitimate family? And most of them are, you know, they do exist. They are people. They've got brothers and sisters and that sort of thing. They are related, which made the Manchester bombing even more interesting, because typically with terror attacks, the people are from all over the world. You never know them from anybody else, and it would be very difficult to track them down. Whereas the bulk of the people involved in this are fairly local. You know, they're not from other countries. I think there was only one gentleman who was, and he was from Poland. So when it came to looking at each individual person, as I say, some of them were just had more profile than others. So the youngest girl, Safi, her family is from Cyprus. So when you put her into Ancestry, the family exists, but she doesn't. And it's because she was never born here. She was born in Cyprus. So without proving it, which I can't unless I fly out there and go see her, there's a strong possibility that she could just be over there and she may never have been over here. And it's just a case of use the profile, the family pick up a check to say thanks very much for participating. And what has happened since the bombing is that they owned a fish and chip shop, you know, takeaway. And they've since received their £250,000. They're selling the chip shop, and I assume they're just going to disappear into wherever, you know, go back to Cyprus.
This is the thing, when you look into these alleged terror attacks, that people make a bundle of money. These victims are receiving sometimes up in the millions. And especially this crowdfunding page called GoFundMe, that one just pops up every single time. And so many of these campaigns were right after the latest Texas church attack. I mean, the day after, I think there was about 62 different campaigns that were started. And in my humble opinion, as far as I've been able to track down, what I believe is going on is, to some extent, money laundering. They're using this whole thing as a money laundering, where money is being pumped in. Just like in Breaking Bad, if you haven't seen that, how they use his...
It's just a front, yeah, I know what you mean.
Front, and then the money is pumped in, made legal, and then also I think it helps to fund these operations as well.
Well, I'll tell you what my research has gone, because as you say, I mean, for me personally, money is not something that I strive for. I don't see why people need more and more of it. You know, yeah, unfortunately, we're born into a world where money is just a necessary evil, and whether there is an alternate out there, I don't know. But when it comes to people who want more and more of it, you think, well, when these attacks happen, how much do they need? And it's made worse, really, when it comes to the UK, because in America, when a terror attack happens, a lot of them set up GoFundMe pages because they need to pay for medical care. They need the hospital bills paying for. So they sort of use that as the angle as to why they need all this, you know, massive amount of money. Whereas over here, we have the National Health Service, which is technically free. You pay into it through your working wage. So why do these people need the money? Yes, they've been involved in a terrible incident, but do they need £250,000? What's that actually for? It's certainly not funeral costs. You know, there's nowhere near that amount of money. So when there's money involved, it sours everything. So for me, during my sort of research, not just into Manchester, but these events, as you say, because GoFundMe crops up so many times, people are always asking for more money. Even Manchester again, they've just recently asked for another 12 million on top of what they've already had. They want more. And this money is actually just being given to them by the taxpayer. So it's coming straight out of the government to the Manchester Fund. It's like, well, who are all these people that need 12 million? Anyway, I keep diverting. One of the things that I found when it comes to GoFundMe and all these sort of things is that one of the main elements of it is what's called trusts. And a trust is, in effect, a private firm that is set up for a reason. So, for example, the Ollie Demengard Trust, you set it up, and then the idea is that you need two trustees, so two people that you trust with your trust. It needs a minimum of two, and these trustees, you have to entrust them with whatever is in the trust. So, for example, you nominate me and somebody else. Then there has to be a beneficiary to the trust. The beneficiary is, you're going to set it as you, because it's the Ollie Demengard Trust. You want to benefit from the trust, right? So that creates the trust itself. And then you can put whatever you want in there. So your house, your car, money, whatever you want it to be. Set up a bank account under the name of Ollie Demengard Trust. So, for example, your car, I don't know if you drive. Do you drive? Okay, right. So, obviously, you must have a Ferrari. So, your Ferrari goes into the trust. So, it goes into the trust. So, because you're the beneficiary of that trust, you're allowed to drive it. You don't own it, because the trust owns it, but you're the beneficiary, so you can drive it. So what happens is let's say you go in a car park and you get a ticket. That person, that company will then write to the, we have the DVLA, which is where all our vehicles are registered. That company then writes to the DVLA and says, who owns that car because we want our money back because he parked when he shouldn't have been. What comes up? The Ollie Demengard Trust. Letter goes to Ollie Demengard Trust, and then it's for the trustees to then respond. And if they know their stuff, they can get out of paying for this parking fee. So you, Ollie Demengard, driver of your Ferrari, are completely isolated. You, it's almost like a buffer between you and anybody who's chasing for money. So if you can imagine that's the very, very basic setup, apply it to these terror attacks, is that the trust exists in advance of the attack. So the Grenfell Tower was set up before it happened. The Westminster attack, the London Bridge attack, they got all roped into the same trust that still exists from the 7/7 attack. So all this money that everybody's chucking at, you know, GoFundMe or wherever, it ends up into a trust. So if you can imagine, who is the beneficiary of a London terror attack trust? Well, it's not the victims, because they're not late. They can't be the beneficiary, because it's whoever was set as the beneficiary at that time. So let's say this £10 million that's donated, the beneficiary is benefiting from the £10 million. So that could be interest. They could be just spending it. It's in the trust. So what happens from our point of view, from me and you, the way we see it is that we're saying that the 22 people involved in Manchester, they're playing their part. So all they have to do is send an application to the trust to say, I'm Mr. So-and-so. I was unfortunately involved in the Manchester terror attack. Please can I have my £250,000? Trust look on the list of approved names. Tick. There you go. Here's your check. And because it's a private company, it doesn't answer to anybody. And what further compounds it is that the trusts will register themselves as a charity. So they're also tax-free. So they've got it both ways. So the beneficiary gets all the interest on the money. The people who play in their parts effectively apply for their money. And because it's all done privately, it's all proper behind the scenes. And as you say, the websites are just the front to make it seem like you're doing a charitable thing. When in actual fact, you're almost funding for the next event.
Incredible.
So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. Is it difficult to find out who the beneficiary is? Or is that sort of...
Yeah, because what you've got to do, you write a letter to the trust and say, who is the beneficiary of the trust? Trustees then respond, not telling you. Private company, don't have to tell you. And there can be infinite amount of trustees as well. You know, it's got to be a minimum of two over here, but it could be many people, and they don't have to be related in any way. It's not a company. It's just whoever you want it to be. So, and because it's a private company, in a sense, the trustees have to take a wage from it. So you can see how many people can get involved in this, and it become a big money spinner.
Do you know, as far as I've seen recently, it's 18 million that they're talking about now.
From Manchester, you mean, or?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is it. It just doesn't seem to stop. And that was one of the things I came across with the documentary, is I started the documentary with the official narrative, and by towards the end, it had changed. So I had to make a point of that, saying, look, you know, I've just gone and told you that the figure was 250 injured. Well, as per the news yesterday, it's 512. You know, is that because they want to spread more money to more people that just are pretending to be involved in it? It's just insidious. It just doesn't seem to stop. And we're paying for it, you know.
That's the thing. But it's standard procedure also with the number of injured going up. I mean, the number of injured should go down. Maybe some of the injured that were very seriously injured would die. So the number of dead would go up, but that would mean that the number of injured would go down. But here I see it all the time that the number of injured goes up, and not just a few. At the Nice attack, for instance, there were, I think, 84 killed and 202 wounded, injured. After 1 week or 2 weeks, it was 303. After another week, a couple of weeks, it was 404. I mean, what happens? Do people go home and then after 2 weeks they suddenly discover, oh my God, I've broken a leg. It must have been the truck that hit me that night and I just forgot. And then they go to the hospital. I think it is to add to the emotional impact, you know, to get hold us in a constant state of terror, of fear, you know, so that we won't start asking questions, so that we would just bend over and say, oh, please, please give me protection. Because, I mean, apparently this threat of terror is so big, so I need so much security. One of the solutions that they've offered around this whole thing, I mean, we have the problem, the bomb, the emotions, oh my God, that's the reaction. And what solution are they into? To body scanners or bigger surveillance, more cameras, more militarized police, anything like that?
The immediate response, and that was again another annoying part, because one of the first things I did was when it happened, straight to Manchester the next day to be at the vigil, because everybody was going to be there, all the TV cameras, and I wanted to see it firsthand. You know, at the end of the day, you're so close to the event, do something about it kind of thing. And one of the first things I saw was the very security company that were there on the night. And you think, how is this possible? How can they be allowed, you know, even just out of respect to these families, they should not be there. And instead, they're the ones who are being the security for this vigil at a completely different area. And then likewise, the benefit gig, they were also the security for that. And you think, if all these children that have been so traumatized by this event, if they saw these guys in yellow, they'd be like, I don't want to go because I can't trust them. But no, there was just none of that. In terms of the actual police, I mean, it went to a critical level, which is the second time it's ever happened. And so, of course, immediately police with machine guns and the rest of it. There was loads of stories to do with that they were going to put armed police on trains. And there's a photograph that was taken of a guy walking down the middle of a carriageway with this unnecessarily big, I mean, it looked so big that he was struggling to get down the carriage. You know, it was just all that for a good few weeks. And then it calmed down a bit. But as you say, when the figures start changing, they ramp it back up again, you know, and it's just to re-repeat what has happened. I mean, at the minute, the stories that are coming out about Manchester are just really weak. So yesterday, there was a story of a girl who's died of diabetes. She's only 18 years old and she's died of diabetes. You know, terrible thing if it's a true story. And they've still managed to shoehorn Manchester in because she was there on the day. She was one of the people in the arena. And you think, the stories about her dying of diabetes, why are you even mentioning this? Because they are, it then makes me think, this is just a non-story. This is just purely being used to re-mention Manchester.
But also her grandmother died of the shock of her dying. Did you know that?
Yep. No, it didn't. Yeah. Don't make me Google it.
No, I've got it here. I've got it here. It says, grandmother died from broken heart hours after being told her diabetic granddaughter, 18, who survived the Manchester terror attack.
No.
Are you laughing? How dare you? I mean, this is...
I know, I'm sorry.
No.
My apologies to the family.
It's... And the whole thing is that this is a Muslim family. Sarah Ahmed passed away.
That's right. Yeah.
At Liverpool, John Moores. And then it says...
is she going to get £250,000, do you think?
Let me see.
I know that they've asked for money to go towards the Diabetes UK charity. I know that they were asking for money for that, but don't know whether the family asked for anything. But this is it. I mean, we get over here at the moment, we've got quite a lot of flooding in sort of the north part of England. And there's this particular town this time last year that got completely destroyed. You know, it was flooded out and they didn't get anything. But then when a terror attack happens, they can't wait to give the money away.
Mm. But this whole thing about this girl who died of diabetes, they're so carefully, they point out how she is a Muslim and her religious commitment was epitomized on a Facebook page in which she wrote, I'm taken by Allah in it. And Mrs. Ahmed said she was dedicated to her religion and understood her identity. All of these sort of subconscious messages, you know, pumping it in, Muslim, and into the subconscious of normal people that are at a stage where they fear Muslims because of these alleged terror attacks. I just want to say that after 30 odd years of me looking into these things, I still have not found a real Muslim terrorist. What I have found is state-sponsored terrorism over and over and over again.
And here, well, that was kind of the point I was trying to make with the documentary, was that, I mean, don't try and force my conclusion on the person watching. It's me and my conclusion based on what I have found, and to try and get across to them, if that person is interested enough and looks into it, they may draw their own conclusion. And then, as you say, you know, I've tried to throw in a few examples for other events where it just seems to be a case of the government are pulling the wool over your eyes. Can't you see it?
Mm. Yeah, I think you're doing a great job there. There's, I wanted to point out a few things. There are two female police officers that are helping the victims outside the arena, or the alleged victims. They're helping a girl and so on. These two women look a lot like two police officers that were at the London Bridge attack as well. I mean, they're, I would say, almost a match, if not a match, a full match there. There's also another guy, guy in his 50s, I think. He looks like a former military guy. He's being helped down the stairs outside with a wounded leg.
Yes, guy, I know who you're talking about. Yeah. He's a correspondent for Sky News.
His name is Paul Campion, and he's right there every single time there's something like that. He's been on for about 5 years, and as far as I've been able to identify him, that's a match as well, at least very, very close to what he looks like. And then he appears right after these different events. He appeared after the London Bridge attack as well. He was commenting on when there were foreign attacks as well. I mean, it's the same players being used again and again and again.
One of the other things that I found with Manchester that I didn't put in the documentary, because it's, there's a lot of information I still have that I've just still not been able to tangibly put together enough to say, look, it's this, and you can see it there and then. So, for example, the military's involvement in Manchester is massive. You've got the Darren Costa, who's the guy I said that gets the torso, brings it back in, that guy who's in the photograph. He's ex-military. One of the girls who went on national television a week after, she was only in hospital for 5 hours, even though she had perforated eardrums and injured legs, but still had a big smile and was happy to go on national television. Her dad is in the Navy, I think. Then there was another guy I came across, trying to think who it was, and when I looked on his Facebook page, they did a thing last year, like the ice bucket challenge, a bit like that. But this was just purely for the for military personnel, you know, people who they knew had either been in or were still in the military. And it was the push-up challenge. And the push-up challenge was how quickly you can do 22 push-ups. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, is that why it's 22? It's just a thought that that's the reason why they've used the number 22, because they want to put the military stamp on it, maybe. But you got, in order to do these things, it's got to be military. You know, it's got to be precision. It's got to involve all the emergency services. It's got to be, because otherwise it would fall apart at the seams.
But I have been claiming for a long time that these attacks that we're being, that we've seen around the world, are so coordinated. I've even claimed, and I still stand by it, that what we're seeing to a large extent is the same group, like a rock band on tour, performing in different countries, being transported from country to country. They're almost all of the NATO countries or the US, in army planes to Navy, no, sorry, Air Force bases or small little airports, where they are being transported. This group consists of crisis actors, directors, experts in pyrotechnics, in makeup facilities, wardrobe, marketing agents, and so on. And then they're carrying out the exact same theme again and again. It's the Allah Akbar, forget the passport, have an ISIS flag in the back, being suicidal on site, and so on. But the same group in transport, the only difference is that you, when you see people running around in police uniforms in Sydney or in Ottawa or in London or in Stockholm, same people. And one thing that they do not do, according to my friend, the CIA whistleblower Chip Tatum, is that normally they try to avoid using local people. You know, so if they do a hit in France, then the people involved in it will be from other countries, from other agencies and so on, because otherwise they would be too easily recognized. And there's an American side to this whole thing as well. There was foreknowledge by Americans, as far as I know. Is that something you can tell us about?
Whether it was foreknowledge, I'm not too sure. I mean, it was certainly that they must have known some, I mean, the link between the Manchester Arena attack and America was strong right from the get-go. And that came from, well, the public were told the name of the bomber in advance because that was leaked by America. Then photographs of the backpack and a little device thingy, that was also leaked by America. Then there was a story about how angry we were that we were that somebody had leaked all this information in confidence. But then nothing came of that story. And then when I was looking at different pictures, I mean, whenever I try and do any videos and when I'm looking into these things, I always try and find the source. It's absolutely essential that you don't just go on Google Images and find the picture and go, well, there you go, here's a picture. You need to know who took that picture and where did it originate from. And one of the pictures you'd have to watch a documentary to understand the layout, but it's called the concourse, which is like a ring around the outside of the arena. So it's the bit that separates the arena from the foyer. And this photograph is taken in the concourse, but looking through the doors back into the foyer. And it's a very unclear picture. Even the original picture doesn't quite show what is inside. You can tell something has happened, but it doesn't show it quite well. And this picture originates from a journalist who's based in London, and he's supposed to be quite an eccentric journalist, and he's always, I think he's right wing, and he'll say his piece. You know, he's one of these that will try and cause controversy, but he reports to the New York Times or the New York Post, one or the other, in any case, America. And he says on Twitter that this picture is not from the arena. Now, what this did is it created a lot of confusion because people like myself, I saw the picture. It's from the arena, like as in the decor is correct, the paint and the doors, everything is as it should be. But then when you think to yourself, well, why is this guy saying that it's not? How can that be? How could he know he's not there? And the actual source of that photograph is still unknown. No, it just doesn't exist. You know, it's not as if, yes, it was me, I was there, I took that a famous picture. It's just been circulated. And as I say, the source is a journalist. And then you can think to yourself, well, if he's linked to America, is he the link? But if he's not there, then how is he getting this information? You know, it's all too quick. So as you say, you know, when you're talking about military operations and so on, of course America is going to know about it. At the end of the day, the concert was an American pop star, and she's going to have her staff who are going to know what's happening. You know, you'd be a fool to think that she doesn't know what's going to happen. You know, this is her part in playing it. This is her way of getting famous, just like the 22 people getting £250,000. It's their way of playing, they're playing their part. And the thing is, how far do you go with it? You look at the pictures of the backpack and the detonator, and even those, you know, they don't marry up to the floor, yet they're supposed to be pictures of them on the floor. And the detonator's been moved before taking the picture, so evidence has been tampered with. It's, like I say, it could go on forever talking about it, but yeah, the link is definitely there.
But since you live nearby, have you been able to get in direct touch with anyone who was there, or anyone who knew someone that was there or got wounded or killed?
No, because one of the things is that a lot of the people that are directly involved aren't actually from Manchester. I found that quite a lot of them are more north than that. So, for example, one of the people who died, they were from an island off the coast of Scotland that only has a population of 1,000. So you think, when you're talking about the numbers game, you know, the odds of somebody coming from that island all the way down to Manchester to be involved in this, ends up getting killed, you know, it's real bad luck, you know. And that was a bit, like I say, that's what it was like with most of these people. I think the most local person was a guy called Martin Hett, who I think lived in Manchester. His brother works for the BBC. Martin Hett has been in the papers, I think, 3 times. He's been on television 2x. And even his story, nobody's actually said what actually happened to him. It's just presumed that he was in the foyer and he died. But there must be something more to it, because he was there with his friends. But his friends have never come forward and said, well, we all left together. Because if they did, the question mark would be, well, if you all left together, how are you finding your friends dead? So they've just never crossed that bridge. All they've done is then interviewed the parents, and they've given their duping delight and their story about how happy they are that he's dead. And then the America connection then kicks back in, because the following week after the terror attack, he was supposed to then go to America to live for a few months, and he was going to be on a chat show thing, you know, in the audience of a well-famous chat show. And you think, what are the chances that this guy with that profile would end up being involved in that?
But he was, he won Come Dine With Me, as far as I know. And he was also, for some bizarre reason, on a show showing a tattoo of one of these soap opera women, one of his idols. And then another interesting thing is that around these things, very often when media looks for people to comment on it or so on, they interview other musical stars, and Mariah Carey is one that is being, again and again, the latest one after the Las Vegas one, where she was asked to comment on that one. And here, at I think it was at Martin's funeral, or at least she was sending messages to film messages to him and on media and so on. There's all of these strange connections all the time, the same people that appear again and again.
Yeah, definitely. What I tried to do in the documentary, and I briefly touched upon it about the funeral side of it, you know, how did he do it sort of thing. And I didn't want to pick on any one particular family, because just like yourself, I mean, you've said yourself, haven't you, that if there were any sort of real to any of this, you know, the last thing you want to be doing is talking badly about them. But from my point of view, if one of these families is not telling the truth, then they all can't be. It can't be the case that one person did in fact die and all the rest are just, the other way around, sorry, is that they all died and one guy's just somehow latching onto it. You know, it's all of them or none of them, so to speak. But when it came to Martin Hett and his family, they were the biggest red flags going, even to the point that on the documentary, I took a little snippet of them carrying his coffin, and they're not even in a church. This is how, unless you know the areas or where these places are, you just presume, oh, well, they're carrying a coffin. There must be a church. It must be a funeral. Well, it wasn't. It was a town hall, which wouldn't do such a thing. So it was nothing more than a place for the soap opera stars to appear and for the cameras to be there to watch him carrying his coffin. And like I say, the little clip I used is of his dad, his stepdad, who's smiling and waving to the crowd. You think, that's not normal. That can't be normal that he's happy that, you know, he's carrying his son on his shoulder.
Yeah, and also when you see the way they carry the casket, it feels like it's very light. The way the angle of the hands, I mean, carrying a casket is really heavy. And here they just play with it almost. It looks, there's a lot of weird things around that. Also, you were mentioning his parents. The way they speak about him, I mean, here he was being blown to pieces, literally, just a few days before this interview. And here they are, so happy. Oh, finally, he became famous. His dream has come true. We're so happy. We don't feel anger. We don't feel hate. Absolutely bizarre. And I would very much like to compare that to the parents of real people or parents of real victims that have been murdered and slaughtered in terror attacks. I mean, this is totally bizarre behavior.
It is. And the thing is, as well as with that very first interview, the mother is holding, and it sounds like I'm picking on them now, but this is what I was trying, this was the sort of levels that I was looking into these people as much as I could, you know, as reasonably could as well, other than knocking on the door sort of thing, was that in the very first interview, the mother's holding onto these teddies, you know, these teddy bear things. And when you look back at Martin's history, he featured in a newspaper where his mum was trying to sell these teddy bears and sold none. So he put on Twitter, nobody bought my mother's teddy bears or something like that. And then suddenly all of them got sold just because of what he put on Twitter. But she's holding them in this interview almost as if like she's still advertising that she wants to sell these teddy bears. And it's like, it's not that it's his teddy bear, you know, and she's holding it close to her heart. They're just for her to sell. So it's like an advertising campaign whilst talking about the death of her son.
So can I ask you about all of these tattoos of bees, as far as I know? Is that a symbol for Manchester, this bee?
It is, yeah. I mean, obviously from a bigger point of view, everybody will say, well, the bees, it's the worker bees and it's the hive and the hive mentality and everybody, you know, you've got the queen and, you know, it's all that sort of thing, which is true to a degree, which obviously plays well with the bigger theme of it all. But Manchester has had the worker bee, because when it comes to England, it's considered the north and the south, and the north are considered the grafters, the harder workers sort of thing. And it's really hard to explain how it is, but yeah, the bee existed beforehand. So it's worked really well. I mean, if they're going to pick a place to do it, they've got the symbols, they've got the location, they've obviously got the people that have done it, and it's just carried on from there. You know, and people have had tattoos done. You go into Manchester now, and the stickers everywhere. Even road sweepers, they've dressed them up to be just big giant bees. You know, so these things are just, you know, going around the streets cleaning litter. They've changed the bins into like honeycomb shaped. You know, they've really gone to town with it to make absolutely sure that wherever you are, you will see something that will remind you of that event. But one of the stranger things is that if you actually go to the arena, there's nothing there. There's like a couple of, they took down the little memorial thing quite quickly. And there's just like a sign that says, we will never forget you or something. And I don't, oh, sorry, go on.
No, but haven't they been talking about totally renovating the arena?
Well, what they've done is, this is the thing as well, is
don't get me wrong. Big bucks again.
Well, yeah, of course. Well, that's the thing with the arena. The way it works is that the arena is named based on its sponsor. So I think it first was called the 9X Arena when it first was made. Then it was called the Manchester Evening News Arena. It's been called the Phones for You Arena. You know, it's whoever's sponsoring it at the time. And at that time, it had no sponsor. So it was just called Manchester Arena. So you've almost got like the McDonald's thing going again. You know, you don't want a terror attack to be associated with a major brand. So it was brandless at the time. So anyhow, a lot of the research I've been doing has been helped by other people as well. You know, people have messaged me on YouTube. I've actually made a few friends off the back of it. We've gone to the event as a group and sort of looked around it and tried to understand it better. There's a woman called Amazing Grace who has a YouTube channel. She came up from where she lives because she'd never been to Manchester. So effectively gave her a tour of it and said, look, this is how it fits. So she could understand it firsthand. And I've lost my train of thought now. What were we talking about? We were talking about the...
That people have helped you with the research and...
Yeah, so one of the things that were cropping up from it was the... what we found when we were looking around as well is that we actually spotted that these little stars that were from the Orlando shooting were actually placed outside the arena as well. And since then, we've been to Grenfell and had a look around there, and those stars are there as well. It's almost like they're leaving calling cards.
What stars are you talking? What do you?
It's again another charity where you send them $15 or whatever, however much this thing is, and they send you like a pack. And in this pack is a wooden star, and you write on it whatever you want. And it started off the back of, I'm trying to think, it might have even been Sandy Hook where it first came about, but it's been more prominent since the Orlando shooting. And these little wooden stars have got things like, you know, lots of love from Florida and, you know, whatever that person has put on there. But it seems so strange that they would end up appearing at these different events, like I say, a bit like a calling card.
So today, when you walk around in Manchester, what if you mention these things, how does a normal individual react?
I would not dare, honestly. I mean, I got a few friends in Manchester who I mean, they know I've got a YouTube channel, and I do try and say, look, you know, please just watch it. I said, I don't do my videos in any offensive way. It's a case of, here's what they have told you. Does it match? I'm not saying he's a liar and blah, 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 and look how fat he is or anything. It's just, he says it happened at this time, but it couldn't have done because it happened at this time. So what's the deal? It's sort of done that way. So, and it's very touchy for them because, you know, Manchester is a big city and, you know, people are very proud of it. So it would, well, like any terror event, really, if you knew it was real, it would, if you knew the truth, you know, it would break your mind almost and make you think about everything differently, which is kind of what I wanted to do with the documentaries, to say, look, it can be done. It has been done. And I'm presenting you with enough to work with to say, look, this can't be right. And one of the other comparisons that I've done in the documentary was to compare it to an actual event that people did die that turned out to be a cover-up and has been proven to be a cover-up. And the families of the people who died went to court and, you know, and stood their ground and spent years and years and years campaigning and eventually got the result that they were after. But these parents haven't done that. So, for example, if I'm saying I think there's two bombs involved, you'd think that the parents would go, wait a sec, if there's two bombs involved, then that must mean there's two people involved. But there's only one guy who's blown up and nobody else is being pursued for this. Something's not right and I want justice. When in actual fact, they've just been given a check.
Do you know, I've been three times to Norway, done public talks, presentations there about the mass shooting in Norway, which is super sensitive. You were talking about scary in Manchester. I said, you go to Oslo and take that teaching. And one of the things that I found very, very strange, just like with you, is that if I was a parent of a child that had been slaughtered like that, I would want to find out what happened, who did it to my child, you know, to find out the truth. And if somebody came up with a totally different version, I would go find out, what is this guy up to? Is he just full of it, or what's going on? I went to Oslo, I did one presentation on Tuesday, I left one day in between, and then I did more or less the exact same presentation on a Thursday. So that what I said was that at the Tuesday one, I said, please, anyone who knows any family or friends or victims, please let them know that I'm here. Contact me, tell me, teach me, you know, show me, and we'll find the truth together. Not one. And after all of these different events, I've always tried to get in direct touch with victims or family of victims and so on. Not once. No, that's not true. One time, an individual from the Bataclan contacted me, claiming that she was there with a victim called Nick Alexander, that he was in her arms when he died. But that was one contact. Then I asked, please, let's stay in touch. She disappeared. So there is this very, very strange thing about these events. And it's the same every time. Like, where are they? Why are they not interested in finding out the truth? Why are they not out there, you know, like, pestering authorities, pestering the security company, saying, how the hell could you let this guy in with a bomb? You need to do this, you need to do that. Wouldn't you be an upset parent and do everything you can could to prevent a thing like this to happen again? But here we see the exact opposite. Silence, silence, silence. At least, and I could have told you before that that would be the same thing in Manchester as well, because if it follows the same template, that's the thing. But this Showsec company, the security company that was in charge this evening, which I also, like you, think if they had done such an awful job letting this guy in with a bomb, would they be hired and would they keep, and they would have been kicked out and somebody else would have been brought in. But here, since they're loyal to the cause, I believe, boom. But the founder of Showsec was found dead a few weeks after this whole thing.
That's right, yeah.
Have you been able to find out anything about his death?
To be honest, I didn't look into it. It was, I remember seeing Analogical, another YouTube creator, she actually did a piece about Showsec before his death, and then his death came about, and it was like, oh geez, something not right. But one thing I have noticed from going back to Manchester and walking around is that they're everywhere now, Showsec. I don't remember seeing them beforehand. Maybe it's one of those things when you're not looking for them, they're there. But now we have, there's a Christmas market, and in the Christmas market, they're scattered everywhere. There's also other music venues, a place called the Academy. I was there recently, and Showsec, they're the security for them. And you think, it's quite clear that is their reward. £250,000 for these people. If you pretend to be injured, you get £10,000 to £50,000. Showsec have now got a big part to play in this. They've now got extra contracts. And the weirdest part about it is that they've now somehow managed to adopt areas of the train station that joins to the arena. They've effectively managed to adopt some of that now, because they are guarding areas that were normally perfectly fine for the public to walk up and walk around. And how can that be? One minute it's perfectly fine for anybody to go up there because there's a car park up there, that kind of thing, but now they're blocking it all off. There were some photographs taken by one of my friends who this is a guy who he messaged me on YouTube. I met up with him, and I'm really good friends with his family now, and it's been really good. What he did is he went to an event that happened, a boxing event, and I said to him, you've got to take pictures of the foyer whilst you're there. So he's the one who provided the photographs that they've seen in the documentary, where now you go into the foyer, it's not a big room anymore. They've made it very, very linear. You walk in through the door, and you're heading straight towards a metal detector, a scanner, and you've got a sniffer dog there, and they've got massive amount of Showsec, and you go straight through the door. You can't just loiter or just be in the area now. It's just go in, go through, stay away, don't cause any fuss. It's very regimental.
One final question. Did McDonald's open up again?
No, they've covered it up. It's got scaffolding around it, and they've put like a sheet covering the area. So it's the equivalent of when these terror attacks happen. One of the key things that seems to happen when it comes to the vehicles is that there's always roadworks knocking about, and when there's roadworks, it's because they can then change the way the road looks after, and therefore if you did go down there and look at it, you'd think, how did they do that? The road looks different now, and that sort of thing. And they've done a similar thing with the foyer. The foyer was one big open room, now it's not, and I think they're going to change it so that you can't have your own sort of perspective as what could have happened, because the room is so different now. So whether McDonald's will reopen, time will tell. And the same with the report. There is supposed to be a final report on all of this in April next year, so who knows what will come from that, but it's not going to be any different from what we know.
Nope. This thing with changing the location is standard as well, these operations. At the Brussels airport, for instance, where they claim that these bombs went off, When you go there now, that part where the bombs went off, there it's closed in and changed so that you can't recognize it. And so, and it's done by design, if you ask me, done by design.
Definitely.
Listen, it's been absolutely great to have you on. Thank you so much for sharing your findings and your excellent research. I really hope that this is going to go viral, your documentary, and anything I can help you with, I hope you know I'm always here. So could you once again please give people a way of contacting you, and if there's any way they can support you with information or whatever, please tell us.
No, that's perfect. Well, thank you very much for having me on. Again, I really appreciate it. YouTube channel is UK in capital letters, and then Critical Thinker. The documentary is on the face of it, Manchester, and primarily on YouTube. Email is just ukcriticalthinker@gmail.com. I've got the backup channel, which is vidme.com. Same again, UK Critical Thinker, if you search on there. And yeah, just watch it, see what you think. Hopefully it's in a style that makes it very simple to explain. I might have rambled on for 2 hours and it might make you put you off and think it's confusing, but trust me, I've taken a good deal of time to make it very, very simple. And yeah, if you like it, share it.
That's the key. Share it. It's good whoever is watching it, but it's so much more powerful when shared. So keep sharing this type of information. Once again, thank you so much, and I hope to have you back maybe sometime in the future.
Okay, perfect. Cheers, Ollie. Thank you very much.
You take care.
Speak to you soon.
Speak to you soon.
Thank you so much for listening to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Take care and see you soon.
Coup d'etat in slow motion. Connecting the dots between the assassinations of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, JFK, Robert Kennedy, and John Lennon. Now available on Amazon and lightonconspiracies.com. Coup d'etat in slow motion.
May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light.